Let's take our Bibles and let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Last Sunday night we talked a little bit about 2 Corinthians chapter 11, which was actually getting ahead for the week just a little bit. And now 2 Corinthians chapter 12, I want to go back to that as part of our reading last week, mainly because something that kind of caught my mind there. My thoughts as I was reading through, part of our reading included this vision of paradise, or maybe we should say this vision of the third heaven would be more correct. A description of something the Apostle Paul was shown by God. And so I think it would be reasonable if we were asking, well, what is that? And what does that mean? What's it referring to? What did Paul see? And why is he telling us about it? Or why was he telling the Corinthian brethren about that? And so some of the questions about that would be, what was this about? And why was Paul revealing it? And was there a purpose for Paul telling the Corinthians? But I think to understand that, if we just start reading 1 Corinthians chapter 12, we still may be confused as to why he's bringing this up even. And I would start by saying this, backing up in our thoughts a little bit. Paul must have had a deep affection for the Corinthian brethren. He would have to really love them to be able to endure some of the attitudes that came from them, some of the things that he had to deal with them. And it seems that his love, in many ways at least, was unrequited from them. They were not good at reciprocation with regard to the affection that he offered them. He was truly concerned about them. He was concerned about their faith. He was concerned about their well-being. He had spent time with them and on one hand seems to be close to them. But on the other hand, I get this impression like in some ways they're almost pushing him off. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't that way. But there's just some things in 1 and 2 Corinthians that kind of leads my mind that way. You know, that there was something going on between those brethren and the apostle. I don't see where he was holding back his care and concern and love for them in any way, but I wonder a little bit about their affection toward him. Well, you know, his work among them was often at, or perhaps always at, no charge to them, choosing instead to make tents or to receive support from Christians in other places because he didn't want to be a burden to them in any way. And yet that did not take away his needs. I mean, if we go back to 1 Corinthians for just a moment, 1 Corinthians in chapter 9, and while the Apostle Paul did not require any kind of support from them in the times that he was among them, he certainly was one who tried to make the point to them that he had the right to expect that he would be supported by them. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 14, he says, "Even so the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live of the gospel." You can't get much clearer than that in trying to make a point. Verse 18, "What is my reward then? That when I preach the gospel, I may preach or present the gospel of Christ without charge, that I may not abuse my authority in the gospel." He had the right to expect that they would help him, they would support him. But at different times, he will say that he didn't want to be a burden to them, or he did not expect this from them. I don't know what the reason was. It's not like, you know, Corinth was a place of poverty. In fact, it seems to be a place of some wealth. And so it's a little bit hard to imagine that the Christians had no ability to help him in these ways. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, part of our reading this last week, the point is made again. I mean, here this is in the context of, in the latter part of this letter, the apostle starts talking more about some of the issues of the false teachers and false apostles. And how he's now starting to even defend his apostleship. 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 7 beginning, he says, "Have I committed sin in abasing myself that you might be exalted? because I have preached the gospel of God to you free of charge. I robbed other churches. That's not the best translation to me. Some translation says, I called upon other churches. That sounds much better. I called upon other churches, taking wages from them to minister to you. And when I was present with you and in need, I was a burden to no one, for what was lacking to me, the brethren who came from Macedonia supplied. And in all things I have kept myself from being burdensome to you, and so I will keep myself. So he makes that point very clear, that he did not expect anything from them, though, as he said before, he certainly had the authority to expect that, but to not be a burden. But I think there's another reason too, because as you continue reading in chapter 11, some of those false apostles, I get the impression that they were expecting that the church in Corinth would help them and give them some kind of support. And they were not what the Apostle Paul was. He's making a point. He's trying to show a contrast of what he is, what he represented, and what these false apostles represented. And perhaps this is one of the reasons he did not expect any support. He's trying to make a distinction. And in some ways, maybe trying to demonstrate his sincerity, that he was willing to make tents. He was willing to do whatever he had to do to be able to present the gospel of Christ and not be a burden to them in any way. But these false apostles were certainly of a different mind. And that takes us into more of as we start thinking about chapter 12, this is setting some things in place about why he says some things in chapter 12. Paul is trying to warn the church about the selfish ambitions of these imposters. Now, you have to give them credit for being effective in what they did. They were fooling people into believing their teaching. And even though their teaching was wrong and they were wicked, you have to at least admire the fact that they were good at what they did. It's not a good thing. I wish they were not good at what they did. But it's the same thing with a lot of preachers today that are effective in what they do, but it's not for good. Paul's trying to make that point. You know, and you have to start asking some other questions. If they are not listening to everything the apostle says, but they are listening to what the false apostles are saying, you have to acknowledge that those false apostles were effective. But why did the saints believe them? Because shouldn't they have been looking for the signs? Because the apostle Paul had been with them before and he had proven his apostleship, even because he confirmed what he said by signs and miracles. Remember, that followed the apostles. That was the proof that they were really apostles. The false apostles must have had some abilities. They were good at what they said. Maybe they were doing some kind of tricks that made people think that they could do miracles, but it could not have been what the apostle was doing. But evidently, these false apostles were effective in their deceit. Well, just like their father, Satan. You know, in chapter 11, going back to verse 12, "But what I do, I also will continue to do, that I may cut off the opportunity from those who desire an opportunity, in that what they boast, they also may be regarded just as we." That's kind of one of those typical Apostle Paul phrases right there that you have to read 8 times to kind of grasp. But what he was saying there, basically, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, you know, in hopes that I will cut off what those others are trying to do, you know, that in things that they are trying to boast of in regard of just what we are doing. Those who are trying to act like us, the real apostles. He's trying to make that distinction. Verse 13, "For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works." Yeah, they're good at what they do, just like their father Satan. That's what he is saying about those false apostles. And he's not mincing any words about that. Because you see, Paul wants to come to them again. That's part of his goal. He wants to come to them again. But one of the things he has to face is those false apostles that have had some effect on the Corinthians. And so now he is defending himself. And he's trying to make a comparison about the things that these false apostles have done as compared to the things that he has done or the things that he may do when he comes to them again. Remember that they know him. They know Paul. Paul was the one that came to Corinth and converted and started the church there, Acts chapter 18. You know, at the preaching that Paul did, there were those who believed and were baptized. And many believe that Paul was there on at least one other occasion. In Acts chapter 19, when Paul was living in Ephesus, remember he was in Ephesus for at least 2 years, maybe three. And it says in verse 10 of chapter 19 that he had been throughout all the region of Asia preaching, which would include as well where Corinth was at. But once again, before he can do what he wants to do in coming to them, he has to convince them again that he's a true apostle. And so that's the context of some things that is being said in chapter 12. He's trying to set in chapter 11, he's trying to put together and set the groundwork of the fact there are false apostles among you. And they're effective at what they do. But they're still not the real thing. And they're trying to act just like us. But they're not like us. They are of Satan. We are of God. And so this is the distinction that he's trying to make. And so he's made points at various times to prove his apostleship. In chapter 11 again, backing up just a little bit more to verse 5, he says, "For I consider that I am not a bit behind the most eminent apostles. And though I am untrained in speech, yet I am not in knowledge. But we have been thoroughly made manifest among you in all things." Indeed, the apostles had. They'd been made manifest. They had been made known. And part of what had made them known was their knowledge in Jesus Christ, confirmed by the miracles that they did. And so, he had demonstrated that he was an apostle time and again. In the latter part of chapter 11, before we get into the chapter 12 text, the apostle cites again the fact that being apostle has not been easy, I guess is how you could say that. And he had suffered many times. He had suffered many things in being an apostle. His sufferings for Christ were far above what most had endured. And I can't help but think and wonder how much more he had suffered than those false apostles. I struggle to think that those false apostles had suffered at all. Because if you put sufferings upon those who are not sincere and dishonest, they usually go away. And so I can't imagine they've suffered at all. But the apostle, yeah, I think we read this last week. You know, five times I received 40 stripes minus one. Remember? You know, three times beaten with rods. I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked. Remember all of the things that he mentioned, the ways that he had suffered in his service of the Lord. And so Paul's commitment to Christ was evident. And it was undeniable. It was known by many. And so now he takes his explanation a little farther, emphasizing what makes him a true apostle. And that is revelations from God. That's what he can claim that false apostles honestly cannot. Remember, one of the qualifications of apostleship was to be a witness of Jesus. Remember when Judas was no more, and the 12 are now 11. And in Acts chapter 1, when there was the choosing of a replacement for Judas, and Matthias was chosen, you might recall that one of the requirements that came up in the discussion then was that we have to choose one, or that one must be chosen, that has been with the Lord from the beginning, as we, is what Peter said. Because Peter and the other apostles, the 12, they had walked with Jesus for 3.5 years. They had seen the things that he did. They heard everything he said. They saw the miracles that confirmed everything that he said. And someone who had seen those things had to be chosen, had witnessed the Lord. And Matthias is whom the Lord chose. Well, for Paul to be an apostle, he as well had to see the Lord. And he did. Acts chapter 9, on the road to Damascus, the Lord appeared to him. And all could not say that, but Paul could. And so now the tone changes from describing what he had done to what the Lord, what Paul had done, to now what the Lord had done to qualify him through supernatural visions and revelations. That's what he talks about in the first part of chapter 12. It's a passage I've never heard a whole lot said about because it's a little bit hard. It's a little bit hard to get a grasp of. And in my mind, at least, until you go back and understand why he says those things, it doesn't make any sense. Like, why did this come up? But almost always in Bible study, we can never draw an accurate, or it's hard to draw an accurate conclusion until we back up and we understand the context in which something is being said. But now we know something about the context. We understand the arguments, you know, that Paul is making to these brethren. You know, he's saying to them, you've been fooled. There are false apostles. They're good at what they do and they're effective. But he's saying, I'm a real apostle. And you know this, and it's been proven to you, but he's having to prove his apostleship again. And so he brings up something that happened 14 years ago. And I don't know that there's anything recorded. I can't think of any point where anything about it is recorded anywhere else in Scripture. But he brings this up to them. You know, these manifestations about what he's about to reveal to them were proof positive of his apostleship. Because what happened came directly by the power of God and were possible only by a proper relationship with God. You know, you think about the signs of Jesus. If we go back in our mind for just a moment, we think about the signs of Jesus. That in the beginning of his ministry, or the earlier part of his ministry, Jesus did signs and wonders that made some have to really step back. Oh, there were still the detractors. There were still those who did not believe he was the Christ. But there were some, like Nicodemus, who could not deny the signs and wonders that Jesus was doing. Well, even the other Jewish leaders could not deny the signs that Jesus was doing. Not honestly, they couldn't. And Nicodemus said to Jesus, Rabbi, we know that you are from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. Remember that in John chapter 3, verse 2? Miracles are a confirmation that the words that the inspired writers or the apostles were speaking are true and that they are from God. The Hebrew writer says it this way in Hebrews 2. How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed to us by those who heard him, God also bearing witness both with signs and wonders, with various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his will. You see, it was by the signs and wonders and the miracles that confirmed the words that Jesus spoke and the words that the apostles spoke. And now again, Paul, an affirmation of the signs he did in front of them. And so he's going to deal with this again. In chapter 12 and in verse 12, he says, a little bit toward the end of what he has to say, but he said there, truly the signs of an apostle were accomplished among you with all perseverance in signs and wonders and mighty deeds. I get the impression that what he is saying, it's sort of the line, you saw the signs and wonders, the miracles that my hands performed. What about those others that call themselves apostles? What have they done? It's in that vein that he is saying those things. What have they done? And Paul's apostleship could not be denied. But you see, it's still just interesting to me and amazing to me that after all of this time, he's having to go back to them again and say, remember, I'm a true apostle. Now, doesn't that say something about the Corinthians? Now, I'm not trying to just run them down the river here. You know, because I'm not sure how we would have responded then. But it's just interesting to me that Paul has had to defend himself with them a number of times. But now to chapter 12. The first six verses primarily is what I want us to look at. It took us 20 minutes to get there. To where I hope these first few verses now, maybe will make a little different, have a different meaning, make a little more sense to us. And so it's in view of all that we've just read. It is doubtless not profitable for me to boast. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. And so it's like he's saying, look, I'm not trying to make a big deal about this. And this is really not about me, he's saying. But I have to tell you about these visions and revelations that have come to me. And yet in his way of saying, you know, it's not profitable for me to boast. It's like he's saying, it's not about me. It's about the revelations and the visions that have come to me by God. He says in verse 2, I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago, whether in the body I do not know, or whether out of the body I do not know, God knows, such a one was called up to the third heaven. I know such a man. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know, but God knows how he was caught up into paradise and heard inexpressible words, which it is not lawful for man to utter. Of such a one I will boast, yet of myself I will not boast, except in my infirmities, for though I might desire to boast, I will not be a fool, for I will speak the truth. But now I forbear, lest anyone should think of me above what he sees me, or to be, or what he hears from me. It's typical Paul kind of writing. Go back and read it about 8 times. It starts becoming a little more clear. Paul speaks here like in the third person, which is kind of confusing to me. But he's speaking about the revelations that came from God. And he's trying to make a case for his true apostleship, that Paul had received a calling as an apostle out of due time, he said in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Remember, he had been with Jesus, Acts chapter 9. He had performed miracles by the hand of God and demonstrated it, and now reveals a vision of heaven that is of godly proportions. I'm not sure how else to say that. Here is a revelation that is unlike many other revelations. And Paul did not want to boast about his experience because it was like it was of his doing, because it was not. It was in Christ, he said in verse 2. And he speaks here in this third person format, perhaps to draw emphasis to the special nature of the event that took place. So unique it was, that he speaks as though it happened to someone else. But the statements in verse 6 and verse 7 help us to determine that Paul was speaking about himself. This is what happened. This is what happened to Paul. He could not even define what state he was in. Was he in the body? Was he out of the body? Had the spirit left the body or not? What he did know was that it was a supernatural experience. That is, it was not by the hand of man. That much he knew. And he acknowledges that he does not know, again, whether he was in the spirit or out of the spirit. But what he saw in this, such a one was caught up to the third heaven. Caught up to the third heaven. Like, what is that? In verse 2, and then in verse 4, he talks about caught up into paradise. Two different places here that are mentioned. The third heaven and paradise. Some people have suggested, well, third heaven and paradise are the same thing. I'm not sure that that's the case. In fact, I'm not comfortable with that conclusion at all. I think it's talking about two very separate places, and we'll explain that here in just a moment. But it's interesting to think about, what is this third heaven? And if there's a third heaven, there must be a first and second heaven somewhere. Well, that's exactly what the Jews believed. The Jews believed that as they spoke of heaven, they could be speaking of one of three places. You know, the Jews held the idea that the idea of the air or atmosphere where the clouds were gathered, we would speak of that perhaps as heaven. And I'm thinking about Genesis chapter 1, and like when it says, "And God said, let the water teem with living creatures, and let the birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky." And so when we see the birds flying in the sky, they're certainly off of the ground, they're off of the earth, but there are some that the Jews thought of that as being in the heavens, in the lowest part of the heavens. Well, then, still in Genesis chapter 1, there's another level. There is that area of the firmament, as some would say, verse 14, where it says, "And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky." Some versions, I think, actually say in the firmament of the sky, "to separate the night from the day, and let them serve as signs to mark the seasons and the days and the years. Let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth." And it was so, and God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser to govern the night. Okay, so we get a picture of that. We're not talking about where the birds fly anymore. Now we're talking about where the sun and the moon and the stars are. And sometimes we even refer to that as the heavens. The heavens are full of stars tonight, we might say. And so, maybe we're starting to see some distinction. The heaven where the birds fly, that's not so far away. The heavens as in the expanse or the firmament where the sun and the moon and the stars are at. But yet there seems to be that there is another heaven, that of that being of God's dwelling place. If we speak about heaven with regard to the abode of God, we know God is not flying with the birds, that He's not with the sun and the stars, but that His abode is somewhere beyond, in the third heaven, as the Jews would have believed. It was here that Paul was called up to see the throne of God. Paul was given a very unique experience to be caught up and to see some things that generally man has not seen. He's not the first. I mean, what about Isaiah? Remember in Isaiah chapter 6? Isaiah had a very unique experience of being called up before God. In Isaiah chapter 6, remember in the year of King Uzziah, or King Uzziah died, "I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of His robe filled the temple. Above Him were seraphs, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, with two they were flying, and they were calling to one another, 'Holy, holy, holy is Lord God Almighty. The whole earth is full of His glory.' At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and the thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. 'Woe is me,' I cried. 'I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty.'" So Isaiah was able to see to the throne room of God, perhaps the third heaven. It wasn't just Isaiah. What about the Apostle John? I mean, the Apostle John in Revelation 4 and 5, I want to preach about that before too long, I hope. What an incredible scene that the Apostle John saw when he was called up to this place, and there he was, he found himself in the throne room of God, and it's described to us in these incredible terms. And without going to great detail there, we're just making the point that John was able to see this vision where he saw the throne of God. Well, Paul, in 1 Corinthians 12, could give no explanation on how this happened, other than by the hand of God. He knows. He said it twice. You know, whether I was in spirit or in the body or out of the body, I don't know. God knows. There's a point of emphasis because he said that twice, that God understood what happened. And so I'm thinking that this third heaven that Paul was speaking of, is he had a view. He had a glimpse of the throne room of God, the abode of God. But then he mentions this paradise and how he was called up into paradise. Now again, there are some who say, well, it's, you know, this third heaven and the paradise is speaking of the same thing. I don't think I'm agreeing with that. Paradise is found in the New Testament. Like one example that we'll cite in Luke chapter 23. Now, you know, we're not going to just look at that, but you'll remember the story. This is where Christ was on the cross, remember? And he said to the thief who had acknowledged really that he was the Christ, "You will be with me in paradise this day." And so if it's understood that the third heaven is the place of God's dwelling, it cannot be the same as paradise, because Jesus went to paradise, or to the realm of the dead. Jesus went there. But Jesus did not go to the presence of God during that time. Jesus went to paradise, the realm of the dead, but not to the place of the Father. Because when he rose from the dead, he said to Mary Magdalene, "Do not touch me, for I have yet to ascend to my Father." In John 10, verse 17. He hadn't been there. He'd been in paradise. But he'd not been to heaven. And so there was a distinction that was being made. And so, considering the text, the apostle is saying, it's not profitable for me to boast. And he's saying that this is not about me. This is about what God has done. I will come to the visions and the revelations of the Lord. You know, he said, I'm going to tell you what happened. And then he speaks in this third person manner, which is very confusing to me. But it's to draw some emphasis, I think, to this incredible thing that happened where he was called up into the third heaven and where he saw paradise. And how this happened was beyond him, but God knows. But why is he telling them this? There has to be some reason. Remember the point of all of this. Paul is trying to explain and prove his apostleship so the brethren will listen to him and not to the false apostles. Remember, that's the reason he's saying all of these things. That's why he has laid these things out. He has in different ways tried to draw a distinction between himself and the others. He's not taking any support from them to not be a burden. I get the impression those false apostles did. And he's made a distinction that way. He's identified that he has done signs, wonders, and miracles to prove and confirm his word. I'm getting the impression those false apostles couldn't do those things. And so he's already had to prove his apostleship this way, that he has seen the Lord, those others haven't seen the Lord. And now here's something that you don't know. I hate to tell you this because it'll sound like I'm boasting, but I'm not boasting. But here is the visions and the revelations of the Lord that I've seen. I've seen the abode of God. I've seen paradise. I've seen where the Lord went. I tell you this not to boast, but he's trying to make a distinction between himself and those false apostles. And to make sure that the apostle doesn't think too well of himself, he tells those brethren in verse 7 through 10 about that thorn in the flesh. I can only imagine that if you've seen the throne room of God, if you've seen paradise where the Lord went, you could get a little beside yourself. But the Lord helped keep Paul humble. And there was that thorn in the flesh. That's where that comes up. Sometimes we go and we read about even Paul had thorn in the flesh. Do we understand why? so that he would not get carried away with who he was and the things that he had experienced, and he'd been in the presence of God. And if he started thinking too well of himself, there was a reminder. I'm not sure what it was. Was it physical? Was it spiritual? Whatever it was a reminder to him, Paul, don't forget who you are. Now does that make a little more sense? Some of the things that he's saying, even the thorn in the flesh makes more sense to me now. Because sometimes maybe that's how God kept the apostle on an even plane. So he would not boast of himself, because it was not about him, it was about Christ, or about God. It was about the one who gave him the revelations and the visions. It was not about him. And so, having looked at the bigger picture in this way, it makes a little more sense to me. And I hope it does to you too. And now maybe we have a little better understanding of that third heaven in paradise. That was not an easy study to me. That was kind of hard to sort out. And I would challenge you to spend some time looking at that, studying yourself. You might have some different conclusions that I do on some of that. You just try to study that out, and I'll do the same. But we're going to sing a song here in our number 8 in our songbook, using this as a closing song for our service, but at the same time, offering as well, if there are any who would need to respond to the gospel, using this as an opportunity for that to happen, for that to take place, if you would come as we stand and sing.